You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Why pay more for a separate CoQ10 supplement? Enjoy twice the benefits with SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced. From the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beat brand for heart health support, the new SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced by Human is now infused with CoQ10. That's essentially like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 ingredients support nitric oxide production, healthy blood pressure, healthy CoQ10 levels, and heart-healthy energy with two tasty chews a day. Plus, SuperBeats Heart Chews Advance are plant-based, so you get heart-healthy energy without stimulants. For a limited time, get a free 30-day supply of SuperBeats Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to RadioBeats.com and using promo code DEAL. That's RadioBeats.com, code DEAL.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, folks. I have a quick announcement. We're changing things up a little and starting a new crowdfunding campaign with Patreon.com. You can still make a one-time donation through our GoFundMe campaign, but Patreon is a little different, and it's kind of exciting. With Patreon, you pledge a certain amount each month, and in return for helping sustain the show, you're going to get some fun benefits like back episodes, exclusive content, show merchandise, shout-outs on the podcast, video hangouts, and invitations to live events. Membership has its privileges, and you can check out all of the rewards at patreon.com/kickasspolitics, or click on the Patreon link in the show notes for this episode. It's a way for you to show your ongoing support for the podcast and sustain the show long term. It'll be a big help to me because, frankly, I pay for all of this out of my own pocket. And believe me, it adds up. Again, go to patreon.com/kickasspolitics. Thanks for your support and thanks for continuing to listen. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi there. I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. Okay, so people ask me all the time, what is my problem with Donald Trump? I have a lot of problems with Donald Trump. I could talk about the fact that many psychologists who have no skin in the game say that he's an incredibly emotionally disturbed person with one or several personality disorders. I could go with his abysmal record as a businessman before he reinvented himself as a reality star and started licensing his name out. I could talk about his clearly misogynistic tendencies and his borderline racism. I could talk about the hundreds, if not thousands, of times he's been caught telling blatant lies, often lying about the most minor of things, things he doesn't even need to lie about, and how he treats the American voters like a bunch of gullible rubes. I could talk about his naive and simplistic understanding of how the world works. I could talk about the many things that he's said that he'll do as president that clearly violate the Constitution, the Geneva Code, and basic human decency. But right now, let's just talk about Make America Great Again. It's a stupid, stupid, stupid slogan. No matter what you think about the state of our politics, or Congress, or Obamacare, or any of that, America is great. Right now. We still lead the world in just about every way, and no country on earth offers more opportunity to its people. There is no place I would rather be than right here in America. And I find it offensive and downright unpatriotic when I hear the presumptive nominee of my party denigrating this country and putting us down in order to create some false sense of urgency for him to swoop in and be our savior. Implicit in the statement, "Make America Great Again," is this arrogant insinuation that Donald J. Trump, and only Donald J. Trump, can rescue the greatest country in the world from self-destruction. Underscored by his naive and largely un-Republican policies on immigration, trade, world affairs, and economics, "Make America Great Again" suggests that things would be so much better if we could just stop everything and go backwards as a society to some simpler time that exists only in Donald Trump's mind, where America didn't engage with the world, where everything was made and consumed by Americans and for Americans, where the borders were secure and the immigrants weren't integral contributors to the U.S. economy, where a 40-hour work week and a job for life was the epitome of the American dream, and where an overall policy of isolationism, more palatably branded as America First, guaranteed America's privileged place in the world. That's bullshit. Donald Trump waxes nostalgic for a golden age that never existed. The truth is, if it had been the way Donald remembers it, America wouldn't be where she is today. And every day, the world is moving farther and farther from Donald Trump's vision of how things were or how things ought to be again. People are more connected than ever before. The countries that are prospering or on the upswing are the countries who are tearing down barriers and engaging with the rest of the world, encouraging free trade and immigration. Countries like Germany, Singapore, Hong Kong, the Netherlands, the UAE, and the UK. I'd read you the list of countries that have the highest trade and immigration barriers, but you've probably never heard of some of them. They're countries like Cameroon, Nepal, Tanzania, Gambia, and countries that I'm not even sure I can pronounce, like Djibouti, Benin, Lesotho. I don't even know. I've never heard of these countries. So ask yourself, would you rather be Djibouti or Hong Kong? And if you don't believe me, then listen long and hard to my guest today, because he's going to tell you where the world is heading, whether Donald Trump likes it or not. And you know what? His vision of the world is a great place. He's Dr. Parag Khanna. Parag Khanna is a leading global strategist, world traveler, and best-selling author. He's a CNN global contributor and senior research fellow in the Center on Asia and Globalization at the National University of Singapore. He's been a fellow at the New America Foundation and the Brookings Institution, advises the U.S. National Intelligence Council, and worked in Iraq and Afghanistan as a senior geopolitical advisor to U.S. Special Operations Forces. He's also the managing partner of Hybrid Reality, a geostrategic advisory firm, and co-founder and CEO of Factotum, a boutique content strategy agency. Parag Khanna is co-author of Hybrid Reality, Thriving in the Emerging Human Technology Civilization, and author of How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance, as well as his international bestseller, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Parag Khanna is a trustee of the New Cities Foundation and a young global leader of the World Economic Forum. He's been named as one of Esquire magazine's 75 most influential people of the 21st century and featured in Wired magazine's Smart List. In his new book, Connectography, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization, he offers a unique and hopeful vision for the future, shaped less by national borders than by global supply chains, a world in which the most connected powers and people will win. On today's show, Parag Khanna will explain the fallacies of nationalism and isolationism embraced by Trump and Bernie, and how the world is quickly becoming smaller, whether we're on board or not. He'll talk about connectivity and trade as the greatest force for world peace. He'll explain how the most connected nations will dominate the 21st century, and which country is beating America at that game right now. He'll discuss how the future will be less about nations and borders, and more about interconnected megacities. Plus, he'll share which cities those are, and how American workers can adjust and even thrive if they embrace and take advantage of the opportunities of a more connected world. Coming up with Dr. Parag Khanna in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
My guest today is Parag Khanna. He's the author of a new book called Connectography, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization. Parag, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Ben. Great to be here.
Well, I've enjoyed what I've read of the book so far. Was this intended as a roadmap slash proposal, or is it more of a wake-up call saying this is happening and you're either on the bus or you're going to get left behind?
It's both of those, and it's definitely what's already happening. It's one of those, you know, when you think about our populist politicians who don't like globalization, connectivity, yeah, you almost don't want to tell them that this is what the world is doing, including all of us. Yeah. This connectography vision is not a vision. It's the world we're building right now. And you don't want people to think too much about it, because then they might start to get in the way of what is, in fact, a really good progressive reality.
Okay, so it's better to kind of leave this under the radar to some extent.
Yeah.
But before they can complain or say,
exactly,
that you're shipping jobs overseas and so forth.
Exactly.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, you know, talking about some of those politicians, you have Bernie Sanders and Trump and their followers who deride globalization and trade as some kind of a boogeyman. But one thing that I took away from your book is that globalization is a huge democratizing force that's actually putting more power back in the hands of individuals and less dependent on nations and large multinational corporations. I wonder if the Bernie Sanders and the Trump people realize that.
Connectivity empowers anyone who can get their hands on it, right? If you are an individual and you've got a mobile phone, you are more connected and empowered than you were last week before you got that phone. If you are a villager who moves to a city, you are more connected. You have more access to services and jobs than you did a week ago when you lived on a farm. If you are a manufacturing worker earning $20, $30 an hour, and you wind up moving to a city and going through a skilling program and learning how to code, boom, you're about to get a job that pays double that, right? So connectivity empowers individuals, it empowers cities, it empowers countries that get more connected by plugging themselves into global supply chains for manufacturing or high-tech goods, knowledge workers. It empowers anyone who manages it correctly. And that applies to America as a whole, right?
Mm-hmm.
America is an incredibly connected empire, and yet there are people within America who are not well connected. The jobs that they had that were connected to global supply chains and manufacturing are gone at one rung of the value chain. They've got to now climb up the ladder. It's like you're climbing up the ladder and the rungs are breaking off as you climb, right?
Yeah.
So the American workers need to get help to climb, to be stronger, to be more skilled and adept. You know, in America today, we have a labor shortage in high-tech areas. So we have, right, unemployment, hundreds of thousands of people who are unemployed, and yet we need hundreds of thousands of technology workers. The problem is not globalization. The problem is education, right? So we need to get that,
right,
straight.
Well, also, we're not giving out as many H-1 visas. Is that part of it?
Well,
should we be a lot more welcoming to immigration, particularly people,
absolutely,
that we're educating right,
yeah,
here?
Absolutely. So in the interim between a scenario where you have educated your own citizens to take the jobs that their own companies want to fill, you've got to bring in people who have those skills to fill those jobs. Otherwise, those American companies are not going to make as much, produce as much, sell as much, earn, mm-hmm, as much, and create the jobs that they create with that revenue. These things are all connected. People talk about getting rid of jobs as if it's just the job that you bring back. They don't understand the complexity of investment, of supply chains, of trade. You know, when we offshore jobs, we create jobs in other countries, and those economies grow. Those people become wealthier. They can then afford an iPhone, right?
Right.
So if we didn't create automobile jobs in Thailand, the Thai citizens wouldn't later on be able to afford an iPhone, right?
Right.
So you don't hear Bernie Sanders. Now, did I put that in simple enough terms? Wouldn't it be nice?
I would. If a politician, me, yes. For some people, I don't know.
Oh, come on, you're smarter than the average bear. But come on, you know, I mean, everyone should be able to understand what I just said, right? Yeah. And yet, no one wants to say that because that would be provocative.
Well, yeah, and the way I, in my simple way, look at globalization and try to explain it to people, it's like the world is one big company. And if we open ourselves up and are interconnected and doing business with everyone, you know, the rising tide lifts all ships. Yeah. And eventually, you know, in this global corporation, if we do educate our people, if we do train, you know, the way that the world is going, it's, you know, the China is the manufacturing hub. You have the South America turning into the agricultural hub, the service hub of India. And if we play this right, it hopefully should end with us being kind of the executive of that big company.
I love the way you just put that. No one has put it so well. It's called the division of labor. It's the operating right. principle in this book. It dates to 19th century kind of sociology and economics, is saying, let us optimize the world's land, labor, capital, production, and say, hey, South America is a breadbasket. America does make all the technology. So Asia, including China, can make all the cars and parts. Let's get the oil and gas from the Middle East and Russia, yeah. and let's all build the connectivity to share it. That's exactly the world that we're actually heading towards. And that's why I call it the supply chain world, a world in which the supply of anything can meet the demand for it everywhere because we're all getting connected.
One thing you say in the book is you say globalization is doing what no amount of UN resolutions in economic redistribution ever could. And I like that phrase because I think it sums it up well. When you talk about maximizing the resources and infrastructure and human capital to benefit the most people, a lot of it starts to sound like the sharing economy writ large on the world stage.
I love it. And that's why the sharing economy factors into this book. I don't just talk about it from the standpoint of young millennials and cities who are now working on TaskRabbit and you know, selling things on eBay and driving Uber. I talk about the global digital workforce, and I also portray it from the migration standpoint. The more open borders we have, the more people who are construction workers or IT workers or in different sectors. You can be a maid, you can be a doctor, but the more mobility we have, the more those people can go to where the jobs are. So it is a sharing economy on a global scale. You know, sharing economy is actually a cute way of saying peer-to-peer capitalism.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And we are able to transact with each other wherever we may be. And I want to point out again, there are amazing American companies that are absolutely pioneering this on a global scale. There's one called Globality that does supply chain matching, you know, for smaller mm-hmm. companies to buy and sell their things around the world, kind of like a free market Alibaba. Huh. Then there's one called Teleport, which is an Estonian / Silicon Valley company. All the cool things from Estonia, right? and there, high-tech knowledge workers can just move for a couple months at a time to different cities around the world and fulfill jobs for companies that need their kind of talent. Creating these marketplaces for these transactions empowers individuals. All you have to do is to sign up and be connected to them, and you will have opportunities that your geography may not allow. And that's why connectography yeah. supersedes geography.
Yeah, and it makes sense because in this gig economy that we're creating, someone's not coming to America to take over someone's
yes,
job for
right.
years at a time
there
and
is,
put them out of work.
There is permanent migration now. People who yeah. are always on the move. There are now 300 million people who live outside their country of origin. That includes, by the way, 9 million Americans. It's the largest number of Americans that have ever lived abroad. That includes me. Wow. I'm an expat. There are 9 million of us. And we are always circulating. 300 million people, I mean, they may live in one place for 10 years, 15 years, but there's among those 300 million, tens of millions, if not a majority of them, who are always moving around from place to place looking for work. And the whole world is becoming like that. We are becoming, I call it, a global migrant horde. and we're all economic migrants searching for prosperity. And it doesn't matter whether or not you've crossed an international boundary. To bring it back home, mm-hmm. the resorting of the American population that happened after the Great Depression, that is happening today after the financial crisis, is an internal reorganization, resorting, redistribution of where Americans are. Detroit's gone. You're going to move somewhere else, right? Mm-hmm. Factories close in Tennessee. You're going to move to the West. People are moving to the South. People are moving to the West. America is always recirculating people based on big economic shifts. The whole westward migration of the 19th century is kind of like that. The gold rush, right? We're always chasing the supply chain and jobs and connectivity. That's kind of the arc of the story.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's a nice way to better guarantee economic stability.
Well, it's a nice way to have a resilient society, because if we were a small country and the entire economy depended on one city, mm-hmm. it's make or break, right?
Exactly.
And guess what? Most countries in the world are like that. They are screwed if something goes wrong in the world economy. And the one thing that they make and export is suddenly no longer demand.
Yeah,
America is the luckiest country in the world because we have lots of big cities, lots of people, free mobility around the country, tons of industries that are thriving at any given time, right? We are luckier than any other place in the world. We shouldn't blow it, is part of my argument.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, because, yeah, we have this great ability to adjust to changing situations, and we've always been very good at that.
Yeah.
And it's disturbing, this mentality now of wanting to just isolate ourselves and rigidly cling to the past.
We don't want to. There are some politicians who are not going to win our next election who talk about that. We have to remember that we are a very open society. We are the world's melting pot. We have more immigrants coming than any other country in the world. So just because some people don't have good information and are playing on populist whims and saying that we shouldn't do what we're doing, it doesn't mean that we're going to start doing it. I want to make sure that we're dealing in reality, not in this like fringe like craziness.
Well, but okay, let's say that I'm less worried about Bernie Sanders, because I know he won't have any friends in Congress. So if Bernie Sanders got elected, what's going to happen, really? But suppose Donald Trump gets a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate, and I'm saying this as a Republican. And
so you're scared, you're a Republican who's afraid of a Republican-controlled White House and legislature.
I would never would have said that before, but the idea of Donald Trump winning the White House and then bullying the Senate and Congress into going along with these crazy wild hairs of his, that does scare me. So but you say that that's not reality. We all of his bluster, we don't have to worry about, because it does worry me.
We have a lot of examples from around the world of how radical movements and political parties and ideologies, when they come to power, they wind up having to temper their motivations.
Right.
And that happens with Islamist parties. When your country democratizes, Islamists may get a whole bunch of votes in the election, but then they'll just screw up the government and then people will vote them out again, right?
Yeah.
So, or people come in, they realize the reality is that, some things are certain ways and you just have to live with it. So the fact that America really does need migrants and all of these jobs, someone's going to one day whisper in President Trump's ear that, you know what, your idea is really, really bad for the U.S., not good for the U.S. And then he'll modify his position. That's what always happens.
I hope so. I sure hope
that's not going to happen, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, yeah. let's hope that it doesn't even come to that. But, I always have this image in my mind of when a new president comes in the very first day, someone whose name is never spoken probably sits him down and says, okay, we know what you said, but this is the reality.
You'll be pleased to know that is, in fact, how it works. It happened with Barack Obama. There's always people who know how the state is run better than the novice who came into the White House. And I use that word, obviously. I'm not trying to be cruel, but if you look back, to 8 years ago, maybe Barack Obama, doesn't necessarily know how to run a great, complex country like this. Maybe no one does. We don't have a good civil service like other countries do. And those are the people who actually know how to run a state.
Yeah. Well, you talk about these anti-movements that sprung up in the early part of the 20th century, anti-globalization, anti-capitalism, anti-technology. Does it concern you at all that history might be repeating itself in what we're seeing right now?
Well, the point of that argument was to say that the anti-movements spring up and then they always fizzle away because they're always wrong.
Okay.
Because I say that globalization, to bet against globalization is the dumbest bet you could have made in the last 5,000 years. Because if you were right, then we wouldn't have had this enormous connectography, this expansion of all of our telecommunications and transportation and energy networks. For 5,000 years, we've been globalizing and globalizing and globalizing. And every time someone says, you know, it's dangerous, it's wrong, we're losing, not winning, and so forth, still it marches forward and it winds up benefiting everyone. So that goes back to that whole sort of, shh, don't tell anyone, because actually it's working.
You know? Well, you talk about how nations are less at war over territory than engaged in quote-unquote tug of wars over pipelines, railways, shipping lanes, internet cables. Is there just as much risk of these tug of wars turning into actual wars, or does this connectivity and interdependence through trade act as sort of an insurance policy against conflict?
Right. It's a great question. So 100 years ago, people said that just because Britain and Germany traded a lot with each other, they would never fight a war. But of course, World War I broke out. Today is different. We not only have a lot more trade interdependence than we did then, we also have financial integration, trillions of dollars of capital crossing borders and held in each other's currencies. Then we also have supply chain integration. Were German products made in Britain and British products made in Germany? Today, Walmart, America's largest company, makes most of its stuff in China. So if you want Walmart to go bankrupt tomorrow, sure, have a war with China. Otherwise, you need to unwind and untangle that supply chain connectivity between the two countries. And if you want to do that at all, which you may not want to do, it's going to take a while. So you don't just stumble into war so cavalierly as one may have done back then. And I've identified in this book the 9 major wars that were predicted since 1991, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, 25 years ago. In the last 25 years, there have been 9 major wars that have been predicted. China and Japan, America and China, China and Taiwan, India and Pakistan, so on, Iran, right?
Mm-hmm.
How come none of them escalated? How come World War III hasn't happened yet? So I talk through each of those examples in the book, and I say, you know, in each of those cases, the incentives to pursue market access into your rival, mm-hmm. To build infrastructure to connect to your rival, to gain the resources of your rival, is actually just more important than fighting with them over territory. So you do fight over connectivity. You don't fight over territory.
And when you do have disagreements among nations, where will these disagreements get resolved? I'm assuming perhaps not in the UN anymore.
Well, not many disagreements really ever got resolved in the UN. So that's
I'm using the term resolved very broadly.
The truth is that most wars actually peter out. They fight themselves out. You know, very few conflicts can you step in the middle and then just everyone stops and steps aside. Until a border is resolved, the conflict will continue. So Ukraine is a good example. People may be listening and thinking, hey, wait a minute, what about that war? You know, but by the way, that's a war we didn't predict in the last 25 years, but it did break out anyway. We're not very good at predicting these things. But to some extent,
that was over resources. You know, the eastern part of Ukraine, it was all about getting that manufacturing base.
Au contraire. You know, eastern Ukraine is a post-industrial wasteland, you know. That's not really what it's about. It's about the pipelines. The value of one day's oil and gas flow through the pipelines that go underneath, the connectivity, the tug of war.
Yeah.
The value of one day's gas flows is more than all of eastern Ukraine's industrial output. Don't kid yourself, right? So this is why it's important to think in terms of infrastructure and the tug of war over infrastructure, not over the war over Ukraine. Ukraine for the last 350 years has been the most partitioned country in the world, right? No country has had its borders shift more than Ukraine.
Yeah.
So one more border shift is not going to actually shake humanity to its foundations, right? But it's much more instructive in terms of understanding how a country can turn off the taps or steal the resources from another country that are now passing through its own territory. Mm-hmm. We didn't have issues or problems like that 100 years ago because we didn't have a global pipeline network that we have today. But don't let anyone think that this is a war for soil. Right. It's a war over the revenues from gas pipeline flows. And that's what's happening in the world today.
Yeah. And that's what you say in the book, is that what wars we may have won't be over land anymore. It'll all be about resources.
Well, it'll be about
seeing that to some extent.
Well, so we'll fight less. 10 years ago, we thought that the U.S. and China would go to war over Arab oil and African minerals. Mm-hmm. Right. Today, fast forward, right now, there's a giant tanker arriving in China full of American oil from Texas. We now sell oil. We're not fighting with China over oil. We sell oil. So China, in Beijing right now, when they're saying, what's our energy security strategy? The answer is not, we're going to fight with America over Saudi Arabia? The answer is we're going to buy oil from America. 10 years. You and I can remember 10 years ago. That's a 180-degree difference.
Yeah.
The connectivity between America and China, the fungibility of the global energy market, the ability to move oil and gas between any two places in the world, and America becoming the energy power, all are very good things.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Parag Khanna. Back in just a moment. If you're interested in my conversation with Parag Khanna, then you'll enjoy his new book, Connectography, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Connectography, written by Parag Khanna, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and today I'm talking to Parag Khanna, the author of Connectography, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization. Well, Parag, I'm wondering, do we focus a little too much on energy? In this connected world where we're all sharing resources, this whole this stubborn idea that we had to be energy independent, mm-hmm. we don't want to be dependent on the Saudis.
And now we're not, which is great.
Well, yeah.
Well, so here's the thing. We have a massive resource discovery boom that's gone on in North America and other parts of the world,
yeah.
right? So the world has a totally abundant hydrocarbon energy, especially gas, you know, much more than oil. And gas is cheaper and cleaner. And now also, again, you have a global market for it. Then we have all the alternatives and renewables, the solar power, the wind power, the nuclear power, the hydropower, and so forth. I don't really worry about global energy supply meeting demand. I worry about the infrastructure being in place, right? Lots of places have abundant sunlight, but where's the technology, the tools, the solar cells and panels and grids that are going to get power to the people? That's what we should be investing in. And then we'll have every place will have enough energy supply, and then we'll never have a war over energy.
Yeah, you do talk about infrastructure as being key to this. What'll separate the men from the boys will be the countries that have built that infrastructure.
Yeah, and I say, you know, it's not countries that the winner in the 21st century is not the democracy versus the authoritarian state or the country that's rich versus the country that's poor. It's the countries that have new stuff versus the countries that have old stuff.
What kind of stuff should we have here?
Well, right now we have a lot of old stuff. I mean, I'm from New York City, right? Our subway sucks.
Yeah.
you know, here in LA, you don't even have good public transportation at all, right? That's why you have this sprawl. Other countries don't have these legacy infrastructures that get in the way, so they build high-speed rail networks. Okay. They've got fiber optic cables, all these things. Our stuff is old. Other people's stuff is new. You can't get on your high horse and say, yeah, but, you know, our average per capita income in America is, you know, $40,000 a year. Theirs over there is only $20,000 a year. We're just better. Fact is, their stuff is newer. They're going to grow faster. They're going to catch up pretty fast. Their quality of life might be better, and so on and so on and so on. So think old versus new stuff, not rich versus poor.
So we're talking about energy. We're talking about transportation. What else?
Communications, right? So that's the third pillar of global infrastructure, transportation, energy, communications. And then, of course, again, how fast is your, how fast are your broadband connections? What's your mobile phone speed? Are you, 4G going on 5G? Are you 2G going on 3G? Are your calls dropping every 2 minutes? That kind of stuff.
Are we lagging behind other countries in that area?
Parts of America are. There are a lot of places. Look, we're a huge country. It doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to be, piping fiber cable to every farm in Kansas. But that said, some places are hyper connected, right? LA is good and San Francisco and so forth. But, you know, there are a lot of second-tier cities that would benefit a lot. So, for example, you know, you could have a lot more telecommuting, a lot more people who are living in cost-effective places. If they had better internet connections, they could be telecommuting to work. They could be doing coding and just working more mm-hmm. seamlessly. So it is a great public service to America if we were to speed up the broadband penetration.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about those areas. Because you say that borders will matter very little in this new era. We're living in a world of interconnected megacities. Does that mean that the person who's living in those places in, say, Middle America, the Midwest, or Sub-Saharan Africa, does it mean that those people are in danger of getting left behind?
Well, yes and no. So the idea of a world in which megacities dominate is already true, right?
Yeah.
But my vision is a world not just of building more and more connectivity among those cities. That's happening anyway, right? My vision is that what about all the other people? I'm actually saying we should be empowering those people. So I have a section in the New York Times excerpt from this book about Appalachia. Right? So we declared a war on poverty in Appalachia 50 years ago. I think it was Eisenhower or whatever. How's that war on poverty going for you? You know, not so well, right? Because it never occurred to people, hey, how about in the 8 or 9 or 10 states in the Appalachian region, how about we have better highways? How about we have some railways? How about those towns and villages get better connected to Atlanta and to Washington, D.C., and to large cities so that they could have food processing plants, so that they could have vineyards, so they could have ecotourism. People would go. They could have real economies, right?
Yeah.
50 years, and it never occurred to anyone. We've tried everything. We've tried, you know, educational interventions and trying to stop drug use and so forth. How about just giving them some good roads, for God's sake? You know? And so I'm all about those people. You know, I want those people to be better connected because it's good for them.
Yeah, and one of the dangers, I think, with the people who are afraid of globalization is they don't want to adjust. Is it a matter of helping people where they are, elevating, building the infrastructure, or is it a matter of people need to change their mindset and be willing to pick up and move like the Okies in the great,
it's,
you know,
both,
during the
both.
Dust Bowl and find the jobs where they are.
So you mentioned that, you know, the Dust Bowl example, as we said earlier, there's this constant resorting of the American population. Detroit has shrunk to less than half of its, you know, peak population size. So exactly what you described is already happening. However, there are plenty of people who've stayed behind. There are 700,000 people there. There are jobs coming back. There are some high-tech things going on there as well. There is investment in new kinds of apartments and real estate and jobs and so forth. I view Detroit as the midpoint of the Chicago-Toronto-North American corridor. And if they build that new bridge between Detroit and Windsor, Ontario, you'd have even more efficient trade, and Detroit would benefit from that too. So I'm not saying abandon Detroit. There is a natural equilibrium, a natural number of people that it makes sense to have in Detroit, given what the economy is, and they're trying to figure out what that is. But I don't think people abandon places, yes, and you should invest in people, not just in places, which is why I want to know why over the last 12 years that we've been saying we need a federal worker retraining program because to help the people who've lost their jobs. I want to know today, what did Bernie Sanders do for that federal worker retraining program? What's Donald Trump going to do? What are all these politicians doing about it?
Yeah. Well, for young people who are thinking about going to college at this point, right about now, what are the mega cities that they might be thinking about wanting to relocate to?
So we have
aside
really
from
good,
the obvious.
Yeah, no, we have really good research around which cities in America and the world are actually providing young students with low cost housing, opportunities to upskill, apprenticeships and jobs, all of these kinds of things that make for a good city for a young person to live in who isn't, you know, rich. And so places like Seattle and Chicago and Austin and Toronto and New York and Hong Kong and Singapore, these cities actually are retooling themselves to provide those kinds of opportunities for young people. So young people should be paying attention to where that action is, and they should obviously make sure that they're there.
Is there a list of up-and-coming megacities, say the megacities of 50
years
from
now? I have the maps of that in this book. There's a lot of data around demographic projections for urbanization all over the world. And so what I've done is to plot the 50 megacities of the year 2030, 2035. And I have that map ready today because if you're going to be a megacity in the year 2035, you probably are already well on your way to being one.
Yeah.
So I've got this map in the book that kind of really visualizes that. And I say, this map, I will not change this map for 20 years. I can tell you exactly today what the 50 main urban archipelagos, I call them, these vast urban zones that are the real economic anchors of the world. I know exactly which ones they are, all 50 of them, and they're on the map already.
Have you made any bets on that yet?
They're all winners, right? Unless they fall apart internally, unless inequality and pollution get the better, which is a big problem in Jakarta and Manila and Cairo and Sao Paulo and Istanbul. There's violence in all these places, right? They need to get their act together. They need to invest in affordable housing. They need to make sure they're not polluting and destroying their water supply. They need to do those things. And if they do that, then all of them will win. We have a huge world population. There shouldn't only be five cities that are worth living in.
Yeah. What's the big one to watch?
Oh, boy. I mean, look, objectively, the fastest growing city in the world is Dubai, you know, in terms of its multiplication of its population, because so many people are moving there. Good quality of life. Again, everything is new. Air conditioning in the desert, no taxes. It's got a lot going for it, right? There's places that are making themselves the Dubai of XYZ. Every place wants to be the Dubai of wherever it is. Baku wants to be the Dubai of the Caucasus, and Luanda wants to be the Dubai of Africa, and Panama City wants to be Dubai of Central America.
Yeah, it's like everyone wanting to be Silicon Valley about 5 or 10
years
ago.
Totally, and I find that actually I live in Singapore. Basically, every place wants to be Singapore. Dubai wants to be Singapore. Every place wants to be Dubai. Dubai wants to be Singapore because it's, again, sustainable. It's clean, you know, good quality of life, no crime, and so forth. So, look, this book is about the knowledge sharing between these cities, what they can learn from each other, because they're always experimenting, and I celebrate those experiments. So, I think that a lot of cities are going to get better and better, because otherwise, they're going to fall apart. The president's going to be dragged out in the street and shot. So, let's be clear that, you know, the closer people are to the center of power, the more they can take action. So if, you know, well, you haven't heard the term Occupy Wall Street in a while. It's happening everywhere else in the world. And they're gonna get their leaders, and they're going to bash their head in if they don't fix those countries' infrastructure.
Well, you also say that there's a new arms race going on to connect the most markets. And you say that China is winning that arms race. What is China doing that we're not?
So China today is the number one trading partner of 126 countries. The United States is the top trade partner of 56 countries. That's a bit of a gap.
Now, but we also don't discriminate against dictators, and China does not have any scruples or a conscience about who they do business
with. To be honest, neither do we.
I
actually list in this book, I don't even put it as a footnote, it's in the main text of the book. I list every awful, notorious country that we have perfectly happy economic relations. Yeah. It's a myth that we put those principles first. Perhaps we should, perhaps we shouldn't. To be honest, my argument is that we should not. The only way to influence a country is to be connected to it. If you're not trading with Iran, if you're not investing with Iran, you're not going to change Iranian thinking. They're just going to ignore you, and then they're going to trade with China. So if you want to change a place, you've got to be the positive influence in that place, on that place. So China is not a great influence in terms of political reform, but you know what it's doing? It's put a lot of money in a lot of poor countries' hands and bought a lot of their raw materials. And you know what those countries did with their money? They're growing. They're urbanizing. If you have friends who are going on a project or sell, if you're selling a phone in Africa, or you're selling consulting services in Africa, you're doing so because that country is no longer a totally poor, backwards agrarian society. How did they get there? Because they sold stuff to China. Everyone wins as a result of what China is doing with its investments. Those countries get wealthier. They buy our stuff.
Yeah. There's such a dystopian view that some people paint with this isolationist mentality that we see right now. But you seem to be painting a pretty optimistic picture. If I could describe this book as anything, I would say it is radically optimistic.
I would say it's cautiously optimistic. Again, you know, I talk about resilience towards the end of the book. What happens in a world that's totally connected infrastructurally is that there are fewer choke points. We fight over choke points. Right now, the world has four major maritime choke points: the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Strait of Malacca, right? Mm-hmm. This is where the majority of world trade and shipping and oil flows. In a world that's totally connected, you're not going to fight a war just because one of those gets blocked by a terrorist or a pirate, right? Instead, you've got pathways around. You can just ship over the Arctic, right? Yeah. You can use Chinese railways across Eurasia. So there are multiple ways to get around blockages and disruptions. So that is the definition of resilience. By building all this connectivity, we're making the world more resilient. So I'm cautiously optimistic that if we keep on doing that, there'll be less and less reason to fight.
Way down the road, are we looking at possibly a borderless world, unrestricted travel, global
passports?
No,
borders aren't bad. Borders aren't bad at all. Borders are a form of friction, and you need friction. You don't want lots of diseases coming in. You don't want terrorists coming in. You don't want financial contagion. You don't want organized crime. Borders are a filter, and they're a friction, and they're a good thing if you're using them wisely to block the bad stuff but let in the good stuff. Right? Yeah. That's what a stable country does. It calibrates the flow and the friction, and borders are one way in which it does that. So borders are useful. There's nothing wrong with having them. However, they have to be done in a way that ultimately benefits, you know, both sides and doesn't hurt itself. And, you know, what people like Trump are saying actually will hurt us, guaranteed, overnight.
Yeah. Well, before we go, you realize, of course, that there are many people who, in the conspiratorial crowd, who hear the words globalization and they think New World Order.
Black helicopters.
Yeah.
Those aren't your listeners, are they, Ben?
What's that? No.
Hey, no. Black helicopter.
Well, I don't know. They might have the mics tapped, so maybe we should be careful.
We're in LA, land of the free. Look, people hear conspiracy, but just remember that we've been engaging in this process of globalization and connectivity for, again, thousands of years. America is the architect. Hello, everyone. You know, America is the architect of the global trade system. We are the most open economy. We are so open to migration. The greatness that America is today is a result of this openness and the system we built. Just because the playing field is becoming a little bit more level, because others are getting involved and getting competitive, that doesn't mean that we've lost or that we're losers or that we should be afraid of it. No way.
Well, it's something to look forward to, that's for sure. I enjoyed the book. It's called Connectography, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization. Parag Khanna, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks again to Parag Khanna for coming on the show. And if you enjoyed today's episode, I'd encourage you to read his book, Connectography, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization. I'll include an Amazon link where you can order it in the show notes for this episode and on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Or if you'd prefer to listen to the audio version of his book, you can download that for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. You can keep up with Parag Khanna at paragkhanna.com. That's spelled P-A-R-A-G-K-H-A-N-N-A. Or follow him on Twitter at Parag Khanna. I hope you'll subscribe to Kickass Politics on iTunes and leave us a review. You can also help us reach our fundraising goal for this year and get rewarded by donating to our Patreon campaign at patreon.com/kickasspolitics or click on the Patreon link in the show notes for this episode. Follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook. And while you're there, recommend Kickass Politics to your friends on your social media. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.